BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to this Moneybox podcast. A surprising ruling by the Court of Appeal could mean compensation for millions of people who bought their cars on finance. And carers will be able to earn more before losing their benefits. But first, inevitably, the budget. The first from a Labour government for nearly 15 years and the first ever by a female Chancellor. Of course, Rachel Reeves wasn't the first to stand up in the Commons and announce tax rises, but the scale of them was pretty huge, about £40 billion a year by 2029-30, and most of that will come from raising national insurance contributions paid by employers. That change could cost all of us more money in the long run. But billions of pounds more will be raised directly from individuals by higher rates of capital gains tax, VAT on private school fees, a rise in stamp duty in England and Northern Ireland, and by changes to inheritance tax announced here by the Chancellor on Wednesday.
The previous government froze inheritance tax thresholds until 2028. I will extend that freeze for a further 2 years until 2030.
Now, that will make a 20-year freeze in the basic £325,000 threshold, where the tax begins to bite. But there was more.
We will close the loophole created by the previous government, made even bigger when the lifetime allowance was abolished, by bringing inherited pensions into inheritance tax from April 2027.
More on that later, which many of you I know are concerned about. Now, as promised, there was no rise in the rates of income tax, VAT or national insurance in what the government now calls the payslips of working people. And some welcome news, as the freeze on income tax thresholds will end, though not until April 2028. Minimum wages will rise from next April. The tax on petrol and diesel won't increase, though bus fares in most of England will go up. Our reporter, Sarah Rogers, went to ask people in Blackpool if they felt they were winners or losers.
I was pleased that fuel was staying the same. My daughter's not impressed with cigarettes going up to £16.95.
Well, the downside was obviously the bus fares, because now they're £3, our bus fares are going to be more expensive than London and Manchester, so people are going to stop travelling.
You get a whole penny off the price of your pint if it's passed on. What about that?
Well, for a whole penny, like, I don't think you're going to miss much, are you, to be fair? Like,
to be honest,
you know,
if the fuel duty stays the same, that's another plus for people who are driving anyway, because that's one less thing for them to worry about with the cost of everything going up.
I mean, to be fair, like, you never seem to, like, win though, do you? Because, I mean, although, like, yeah, minimum wage goes up, like, you still, everything else goes up, so you're always chasing and you're never any better off, I don't think, really.
The only thing I remember is that the employers paying more national insurance instead of the people.
Minimum wage is going up?
So they should.
It should, yeah. It definitely should. As far as I can tell, it's not been too bad. It's swings and roundabouts, isn't it? It's got to get the money from somewhere.
Well, riding those swings and roundabouts and working out the ups and downs, the round and rounds, are two tax experts who've spent many hours at the fairground, or unfair ground, as some of you think, since Wednesday afternoon. And with me in the London studio is Robert Salter. He's a director at tax and business advisory firm Blick Rothenberg. Now, Robert Salter, we've spent many money boxes talking about what Rachel Reeves might do, but were the big wins for people the things she actually didn't do?
I would agree with that. In some ways, for a lot of people, it was quite a quiet budget. You know, a lot of the things we feared that was going to happen beforehand haven't materialised. And where she has raised taxes, and obviously the employers NIC is a big tax rise, it's not directly on the working people.
So what things didn't she do and you're pleased about?
Well, obviously there was a suggestion that pensions contributions and the tax relief from pension contributions would be capped, which would have kind of discouraged people saving into pensions. Also, alternatively, having employers NIC and pension contributions. Again, the fact that that hasn't materialised, I think, is a good thing. So, you know, those are two very big things which, you know, we, from a pensions perspective, we don't save enough anyway. So trying to keep that side of things consistent and safe, I think, is a win for basically everybody in paying into a pension scheme. And, you know, 80%+ of the working population do pay into pension schemes.
Yes. And now, you mentioned national insurance, and of course that will rise for employers, just the rate of it, from a lower base and an extra a higher rate, raising £25 billion. But some smaller businesses will be protected. How will that work?
So basically, yes, everybody historically got, all employees historically got something known as an employment allowance, which basically meant if they had pension contributions, NIC, employer NIC contributions, you know, £5,000 or so was basically tax-free or NIC fee, so they didn't have to pay the charge. Now, that's gone up to £10,500, and actually one or two of the easements or restrictions have actually been made better. So a lot of smaller employers, you know, with three, four, five employees probably, you know, won't be affected by the change. It's going to be probably bigger companies. And certainly, you know, some of the major companies have said it's going to be really, really expensive for them.
Yes, I mean, certainly some smaller businesses have said actually they'll be slightly better off. But the Office of Budget Responsibility has said those extra costs on businesses will affect most of us in the long run in higher prices and reduced job opportunities.
Absolutely. Obviously, you know, higher prices lead to inflation. Obviously, that's a tax in a way on everybody. The other side of it as well is, you know, I'm sure my boss will look at my cost of salary and say, OK, how can I reduce that going forward? My future pay rises might be slightly less.
Well, stay with us, Robert, but also in our Carlisle studio is Helen Thornley, a technical officer at the Association of Taxation Technicians. Helen Thornley, an increase in the rates of capital gains tax, which I know is your special subject. So if you sell shares or works of art that have grown in value, the gain is taxed. Now, that came in at once on Budget Day. What will it mean for people?
Yes, so what it means is that we've now equalised the rates. So there was always higher rates for residential property, and now shares, land and expensive artwork will also now, the lower rate will be 18% and the higher rate will be 24%. And that does mean we're all going to have a little bit more work to do for the people who make disposals, working out their gains up to and including the 29th of October and separating them from the gains on the 30th of October onwards that will all be at these higher rates.
Yes, a bit more work. And of course, it, as you came in on the day, which is surprising, isn't it? Now, people hearing capital gains tax think, oh, like that, well, the lady in Liverpool, nothing to do with me, I don't pay capital gains tax. But it can spring up and bite you unexpectedly, can't it?
Yes, it can do, because there's quite a lot of people that have, say, got shares from various privatisations over the years and demutualisations of banks. So a number of people may well have shares and have to think about this. But your first £3,000 of gains is always tax-free.
Yes, and you can take off expenses if you can find some to take off. Now, of course, the Chancellor also announced the end of the long freeze in the personal tax allowance. And that's the income we can have before we pay income tax. But she said, in fact, it won't end for another 3 years. That's a 7-year freeze, the longest for 60 years. How's this affected us?
It's huge. I mean, it's generated billions of additional tax for her each year because so many more people have come into tax because their income's gone over the threshold, the personal allowance threshold, 12,500. And so many more people have come into higher rate tax because they've exceeded the roughly 50,000 limit. So by 2027-28, there'll be 40 million taxpayers. That's an extra 4 million taxpayers than we have now.
Yes, and of course, she's not undoing that, is she? She will just raise it with inflation from that date in April, in 2028.
Yes, we're not going to see any increases until then, and it's very unlikely to catch us back up to where the personal allowance would otherwise have got to.
Yes, now we've had a big reaction in our inbox to the announcement that unspent pension pots will be subject to inheritance tax from 2027. Here's David and Andrea.
Dear Moneybox, this does affect me because I've worked all my life and paid into a pension. It's not necessarily that it's a wrong thing to do, but everybody's planned for years for pension. When I cashed in a defined benefit pension scheme, it was partly based on the fact that the money would then not be subject to inheritance tax and could be handed to my children. And that was, you know, 10 years ago. When you fiddle with pensions, you're playing with fire, really.
Some time ago, I took my defined benefit pension scheme out into a person pension, partly or largely so I could leave it to the children once I died. And I understood that as long as I die after I'm 75, then they would be able to draw it out as income and pay tax on it, which is fine. You know, you don't expect to have it for nothing. But I'm not clear from the new rules what will happen. I mean, will it be like a house and they have to literally liquidate it in order to pay 40% tax on it, which will be quite substantial? Or will they be able to take it out and then have to, as a salary, and then have to pay 40% on it, which seems a huge amount. But it's just not very clear to me at the moment what will happen with the pension rules.
Robert Salter, there has been a lot of confusion about this. They both cashed in perfectly good company pension schemes to pass it on, which of course isn't what pensions are for, but many people have done that. How will it work?
It's
complicated.
And it'll be interesting to see if things change between now and the kind of the full introduction of the law, because it is going to be a controversial decision. But certainly, you know, where you've got specifically money purchase DC type arrangements and you've got uncrystallized funds. So, for example, if you're just taking, you've taken the lump sum out, that's already going to be in your inheritance pot if you've kept it. but where you've taken money down, not as an annuity, but just as a drawdown, that is now going to be part of your inheritance tax. So it's going to certainly put more people into inheritance tax going forward. And how that will be paid, potentially, I suspect, the pension funds may be able to direct that directly to HMRC. We've seen it in other areas where they've done that. So that's how I think it will work in the long term.
That's the idea, though. It might be very complicated if you've got a number of them. And Helen, there have been claims in the press that the pension will be taxed twice, once for inheritance tax and then a second time as income is drawn down. Is that right?
I mean, that's how it's going to work, that yes, the pension scheme and will advisors will have to liaise with your personal representatives and then pay their share of the inheritance tax. But I think in terms of what's left over being taxed, that's probably no different to really if you inherited, say, a rental property or a share portfolio, you would pay inheritance tax on the value of the asset, and then you'd still have to pay income tax on any gains, on any income or profits made from those assets. So it's putting pensions on the same footing as other assets you might inherit.
Yes, and very briefly, Helen, should people who've made arrangements like David and Andrew, should they be looking at them again, briefly?
Yes, I think they should very much be taking advice on their individual circumstances.
It's going to be a lot of people. Now, there was a change to stamp duty as well. Stamp duty surcharge on second homes in England and Northern Ireland went up from 3% to 5%. Chris sent us an email saying this.
Does the 2% rise in stamp duty on second home purchases apply to people who have already begun to buy a property? We had our offer accepted a couple of months ago and are almost at the point of exchanging contracts. But a 2% increase for us may well be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Robert, will it apply to him?
It will do on the basis that, you know, he hasn't completed by the budget date and he hasn't even had an exchange by the budget date sort of thing. So those people are going to get caught. Where you had exchange but you still haven't had completion, you should be fine because there is transitional arrangements in place. But where you've, you know, you've given the offer but the legal paperwork hasn't kind of processed anywhere yet, those type of people are going to be caught by some cost, extra cost that they hadn't budgeted for.
Yes, so that straw may well break Chris's camel's back. And Helen, very briefly, other changes from April, which again, I suppose you've got to make sure you get your deal done before that date.
Yes, we've had a temporary reduction in the residential rates of stamp duty land tax and they will expire at the end of March next year. So you'll start to pay stamp duty land tax over the tax-free amount is currently £250,000 and it will drop to £125,000. So I think February, March next year, there'll be a lot of people panicking to complete.
And a reduction for first-time buyers. We must leave it there. Helen Thornley and Robert Salter, thanks. Now, as we mentioned, the Chancellor also announced a rise in the national living wage for people aged 21 or more. That's from £11.44 an hour to £12.21 an hour from April 2025. And that was matched by a big change in the earnings limit for people on carers' allowance, who can currently earn only £151 a week before losing their benefit. And that's about 13 hours on minimum wage. But from April, carers will be able to earn £196 a week, which is 16 hours at the new national living wage before their carer's allowance is lost. And that will mean a lot to people like Amina, who's been caring for her mum for 12 years since she had a stroke.
This news has been very inspiring and positive for me. It means that I have less anxiety regarding going over the pay and less worrying and stressing about dealing with consequences regarding the DWP. This is probably the best news I've heard in the past 12 years. It means that I can worry less about money and be able to spread the cost throughout the month to pay bills and also having enough money to pay for food. But the best part about this, it gives carers the opportunity to work more, which is what we want.
Well, listening to that is Emily Holzhausen, Policy Director at Carers UK. Emily, you've been on the programme a lot talking to us about the cliff edge problem. You work, you earn a penny too much, you lose it. How much difference will this rise make?
Well, I think it'll make a significant difference. We've been told over the years of carers having to reduce their working hours just to stay within the limit, just because the national living wage has not gone up as because the earnings limit hasn't gone up as far as the national living wage. So it's good news. We've been contacted by lots of carers who say it will make a real difference. We've seen lots of carers also give up work simply because they can't get the right work or hours and keep within the earnings limit. Mm. So we'll see about 60,000 benefit, mainly women and a lot of people on low incomes. So we're very pleased.
Yes, but they will still face that cliff edge, won't they? A penny over £196, you lose your whole £81.90 benefit at current rates.
Absolutely. So this doesn't go away. This problem potentially of overpayments, people will have to keep an eye on things. And that's obviously something which we're asking government to change so that people don't have that very difficult cliff edge. And of course, you know, we do want to see other things for other carers who can't work as well.
I'm sure you'll talk to us about that in the future, but I must end it there. Emily Holtzhausen, very good to talk to you about a bit of good news for carers. And there's lots of advice on the carersuk.org website. Now, it wasn't just the budget that needed careful study this week. Banks and car dealerships have been poring over a 25,000-word ruling by the Court of Appeal, which will mean big changes in the way they sell car finance and could lead to billions of pounds of compensation for people who bought their cars or other vehicles on finance. The court found in favour of three separate customers of two banks who complained that secret commission deals between lenders and car dealerships unfairly added hundreds, even thousands of pounds to the cost of their cars. The court agreed and ordered the banks to repay this hidden commission. Our reporter Sarah Rogers has been looking into this. Sarah, lots of people buy cars on finance deals, don't they?
Yeah, some 2 million people buy their cars using finance each year, about 4 in 5 personal sales. And since the ruling, some lenders, including Lloyds Banking Group, which is the biggest motor finance provider among the UK's high street banks, temporarily paused its commission deals in its motor finance business.
So can you explain exactly what this case was about, Sarah?
Yeah, so this case was brought against Close Brothers and First Rand Bank by three people who claim they were unaware their lender was paying commission to the dealership selling them the cars. I spoke to Marcus Johnson, who in 2017 bought a car just after passing his driving test. The dealership sorted his finance agreement with Motonovo Finance, which is part of First Rand Bank. According to the court documents, he said he was brought an enormous amount of paperwork to sign then and there. The paperwork meant he ended up paying £1,650 in commission, which worked out at around 25% of the total amount he borrowed. Here's what he had to say about it.
It was my first ever car. I had never been to a dealership or anything before. As far as I was aware, they were making money on the cash price of the car. So I just assumed it was traded in. They would put a few pounds on the car once they tidied it up or whatever, and then sold it on at a higher price, making their money in the price of the car. It was so disappointing. I was so upset that I had made such a stupid decision. But at the time, I suppose there was no way of knowing or finding out. But if I had known at the time, I would never have gone through with the deal at all. I would have just walked away.
Now, the dealerships weren't going against rules and regulations of the industry arranging finance this way, but the court ruled on something totally separate called fiduciary duty, which means when lenders and car sales firms are arranging these deals, they need to act in the best interest of the consumer and not themselves. It said that customers should be aware of commission agreements and, quote, burying such a statement in the small print which the lender knows the borrower is highly unlikely to read will not suffice. Now, Close Brothers told us it disagrees with the court of Appeal's use of the law in this way and said it intends to appeal the decision to the UK Supreme Court. First Rand didn't respond to our request for comment, but the chief executive of the Financial Conduct Authority said this week it was important that the Supreme Court considered the case.
But unless that happens, Sarah, and it's overturned, this is a law which presumably will have implications across the whole industry. You mentioned Lloyds stopping commission payments. What else has been the effect?
Well, this ruling has had a massive shock and impact to the industry. There are reports that people have gone to pick up their cars only to be told the paperwork needs redoing, and other lenders have paused commission-based finance agreements too. Now, the Finance and Leasing Association, which speaks for car lenders, said it's extraordinary that the regulations underpinning a market of this size and importance should prove insufficient to comply with the law. We feel for customers who have found themselves, like lenders and dealers, caught up in this legal and regulatory conundrum.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, who better to sort out a legal and regulatory conundrum than solicitor and consumer champion Gary Rycroft. Gary Rycroft, the Court of Appeal said all three of these claimants were what it called relatively financially unsophisticated individuals. They're all getting their commission back. Does that mean millions of people who've bought a car on finance can get the commission back?
Yes, it probably does, Paul. And as Sarah's just been saying, what's eye-catching and significant about this case is that car dealers have been told that they have a fiduciary duty. As Sarah says, that's a duty of care to act in the best interest of a third party and not put yourself in a position of conflict. Now, it does normally apply to people like me, to solicitors who are looking after vulnerable people. As far as I know, it's not applied to car dealers before. But here's the thing. When you're in the car showroom, the car dealer sometimes has two hats. He is selling you the car, as Marcus was saying, and you expect to do a bit of argy-bargy there and negotiation. But the car dealer is also acting on behalf of a lender selling you car finance. And that's the thing that's put them on the hook for the fiduciary duty. And so this test case will apply across the board. And therefore, millions of people who've had car finance may well be entitled to millions of pounds of compensation.
Yeah. So, I mean, should they actually have two people, you know, one for the shiny new car where they're perfectly entitled to get commission if they get a good price for it, another for the dull but expensive finance where they're acting as an agent, and then this fiduciary duty that they've got to act in your interests, not their own interests, comes in?
Well, I think that is one way that it might be addressed in the future. And certainly the car industry and the car finance industry are going to have to look at changing things and the way they deal with people moving forward. They're going to have to bring in safeguards, because what this ruling is saying is, actually, we want people who go into car showrooms to be in a position to make an informed decision about what they want to do. As Marcus was saying, he thought the profit was in the resale of the car. He didn't realise the enormous profit that was in the finance deal. And that's the point. If you don't realise, you're not going to negotiate.
Yes, I mean, we had an email from Neil. He bought a boat on finance from one of these two banks. He said he was never told about commission. Could it go beyond cars to other things?
Well, yeah, yes, I don't see why not, actually, because the same principles apply, don't they? So it's not just about car finance. It's about finance when you are buying a big ticket product like that and you think you're in the showroom to talk about the price of the thing you're buying, whereas actually the dealership are actually thinking you're going to be good to get some profit in terms of the finance deal. And if you don't know that, then you're not in a position to strike a good bargain.
Yeah, the court was very clear, wasn't it? Secret commissions, they called it, and hidden commissions. Now, there is something else going on with finance briefly. Earlier this year, we reported that the Financial Conduct Authority was looking how car finance was sold before 2021. That was a different case, but perhaps with similar outcomes.
Well, it was a different thing. So the so-called discretionary commission agreements have now been banned from about 2021 onwards. But there's lots of historic things out there, and that's what the Financial Conduct Authority are looking at. They're looking into those historic cases and carrying out a review. And they're deciding, for instance, whether there might be some scope for having a scheme put in place so that people who have been a victim of these DCAs will be able to apply through a scheme for compensation, which I think will be a great thing, because it means that people will be able to do it for themselves rather than using a claims company.
Yes, and those arrangements were that if they made you pay a higher rate of interest than they needed, obviously it was in their interest because then they got commission, that was not allowed. And you mentioned agents, and very, very briefly, Gary, lots of claims management companies are trying to get people to make claims, charge them a lot of money. Can people do it themselves in a way?
They can do it themselves, and yes, please do it yourselves. The risk is that a scandal like this begets another scandal because claims companies step in. So sorry to all the lawyers out there, but we must encourage people to do it for themselves.
Okay. Listen to this lawyer, don't pay another one. Thanks very much, Gary Rycroft. Well, you can email all your swings and roundabouts, fair or unfair, to us, moneybox@bbc.co.uk. You can also send a message or voice note, which we love, on WhatsApp, 03306 783 103. That's 03306 783 183. We do read them all, and you might get on the show. In this podcast, the team was Sarah Rogers, Neil Morrow, Emma Smith and Joe Krasner. Studio manager, Lindsay Akerst. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Paul Lewis, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds. And now, young again, if only.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young, and I'm happy to tell you that Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, is back with more conversations with people who fascinate me. In the new series, we'll hear from the comedian Miranda Hart.
Part of being human is that we are vulnerable.
The writer Irvin Welsh.
It's quite a thing to be 8 years old and then suddenly to have a criminal record.
And we'll begin with a conversation with the actor Minnie Driver.
What do you wish you'd understood about the movie business?
It's all ephemera. None of it is real.
Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Science.